Welcome back to another episode of Winning Through Culture. I am excited today to be here with Carl Sharperson Jr. He is a leadership innovation strategist, speaker, author, and coach. Carl focuses on taking leaders from mediocre to maximizing their potential, both in work and their personal life. He's an author, and we're going to talk a little bit about his books today. He's got a great background in the military. We'll talk a little bit about that, and a great background in corporate life. So welcome, Carl. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. The pleasure's mine.
Well, it's an honor. So you are a graduate of the United States Naval Academy. You're a former U.S. Marine Corps pilot. You've been a sales and operations executive for large companies, Procter & Gamble, Frito-Lay, and now you're currently a speaker, author, and coach, also a father, a husband, and I know we share a common interest and work on a board together that serves the veterans community in the upstate of South Carolina. Please just share a little bit more, though, if you would, Carl, about your life, because I think you have a fascinating story and what led you to entrepreneurship and why you are so passionate about supporting leaders.
Well, I'll start from the beginning. I was born in Washington, D.C., in an environment where everybody looked like me. At the age of 14, my dad decided to move us to Spotsylvania, Virginia, which is about 60 miles south of Washington, D.C. So we moved there. I went to an environment where I didn't know anybody. That was a pretty traumatic experience for me. And my high school coach was the third most influential person in my life. He's the one that sent a recruiter to my high school to recruit me to play football at the Naval Academy. And I didn't know what the Naval Academy was, and it was only 90 miles up the road. So he gave a talk that I'll never forget. My ninth grade year, I went out for football for the first time. And he said, "You got your pads today. If you don't want to play, turn them in, no harm, no foul. But if you come back tomorrow, I need you to stay until the end of the season because quitters never win and winners never quit." He said, "If you quit my football team, you might quit school. And then you might quit your spouse if you get married. And you might quit your children if you have children. Because once you quit the first time, it's easier to quit the next time." So I developed a mindset at a very young age never to quit. Fast forward to my senior year in high school, I was the most valuable player of the football team. And after the season was over, myself and three buddies got called to the office. We didn't know why we got called to the office. In walks this guy, 6'2", blue suit, white shirt, blue tie, white cover. He says, "I'm from the Naval Academy, and I want to recruit you to play football at the Naval Academy." The other two guys walked out. This was during the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was still going on, and they said, "I'm not going to the Vietnam War." I listened because my dad always told me, never turn down an opportunity that you haven't been offered. So I listened and didn't know a whole lot about the academy. Went home and talked it over with my dad, who knew a lot more. He says, "It's a pretty good opportunity, son." So I said, "Okay, I'm going for it." I applied, and I did not get in initially because I was not academically competitive. My GPA scores and my SAT scores were not competitive. They offered to send me to a preparatory school in Harlingen, Texas, the southern tip of Texas. Got on a plane for the first time, learned to study for the first time. I reapplied and got accepted to the Naval Academy. Entered the Naval Academy, played football for 4 years, got out of the Naval Academy, decided to go into the Marine Corps, decided to become a pilot in the Marine Corps. So I went to flight school, became a pilot. After 5.5 years, I got out of the Marine Corps, worked for Procter & Gamble for 5.5 years in Albany, Georgia, and Cincinnati, Ohio. Then I worked for Frito-Lay for 3 years in Indianapolis, Indiana. Then I worked for Colgate-Palmolive for 6 years in Topeka, Kansas. And then in 1999, I moved to Clemson, South Carolina, where I currently live, as the vice president of manufacturing for Dunlap Schlossinger. We made Dunlap and Schlossinger Maxfli golf balls and clubs. Been married 37 years. I have a 35-year-old son, a 32-year-old daughter, and I try to help change this world and make it a better place.
Wow, and you've done an impressive job of that. Thank you for sharing that story. I've heard it before, but I thought it would be very interesting for our listeners. And, you know, it speaks to a lot of things, one of which is having an open mind, two of which is, to your point, never quitting, and three of which is the power of long-term sustained vision and action towards a really foundational principles. I know your father was a huge influence in your life, and we'll talk a little bit later on about a book you wrote about parenting to pass on some of those lessons. You know, you've worked with a really impressive list of clients, Carl, BMW, Clemson, and you've got, you know, 20 plus years now of real life experiences, both in the military, corporate America, and in entrepreneurial settings. In today's day and age, what's the number one or two issues or questions that come up in your interactions and coaching with leaders?
That's a great question. And this, it came to light for me when I was working for Colgate-Palmolive. I went to a program called the Looking Glass Experience, which is a program that's put on by the Center for Creative Leadership in Greensboro, North Carolina. The Center for Creative Leadership is one of the top non-academic institutions in the world. I went there to quote-unquote get fixed.
Repair shop for leaders.
Right. So I go to this program, and you come in with 25 executives from all different walks of life. The one thing that they all have in common is that they're all very good. So you go in and you simulate running a company for a day. Everybody has a position. And then there's one person that's looking at each division. So each person is looking at seven. It's 1-on-7. And while you're there, that facilitator is observing you to give you some feedback on how you impact the organization, how the organization impacts you. And it was really the first time that I got some accurate, timely, and specific feedback. So at the end of the simulation, the lady that was running it, I said, I think I'd like to become a facilitator. She says, really? She says, I think you'd be a good one. She says, if you can come back and train with a lead facilitator for a week, three different times, I'll certify you as a facilitator, as an adjunct. So part of my developmental plan when I went back was to get certified. So I got certified. Then I had an opportunity to do probably about 15 of these sessions over a 7-year period. So we're talking 21 times 7 people, very, very accomplished people from all walks of life. So at the end of the simulation, one of the questions you get asked is, what is the most important thing that you can work on to become a better leader? 99% of the time, they would say work-life balance. They would say, I'm making a lot of money. I've been married, my third wife, and she just filed for divorce. They'd say, I'm traveling all over the world, and I'm a big wig. I'm 60 pounds overweight, and I just had my third stent put in. They would say things like, hey, this is a dream job. It's exactly what I wanted. I have two children. One doesn't know me, and the other one's on drugs. Those were the things that high-performing executives were telling me. So the most important thing, or the thing that I get more than anything else, especially with high achievers, is being able to prioritize their life and make sure that they're working on the right thing as their priorities change in life.
That is a theme we have unpacked in past episodes. And it's, I think, in my, again, earlier conversations with you prior to recording this, we talked about, and I really admire, because it is a topic that, candidly, a lot of people stay away from until it's too late. You know, I'm curious, Carl, when you think about that repetitive theme that you've seen, what is, I mean, as a coach to people that might find themselves in that situation, what are some of the things you are encouraging them to do to modify their lifestyle, to bring, you know, balance is always an interesting conversation, but bring a little bit more of a whole person, healthy whole person balance into their life?
Yeah, I believe in keeping things simple. So one of the things I always ask, and one of the things I've tried to stay constant in my life is three things: eat right, get sleep, and exercise. So throughout my life, I've always done it. That's something that should never change. So that's one thing that you can do to maintain healthy balance. The other thing is that I believe that there's seven pillars in everybody's life that are important to them. It's faith and or religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's family, it's finances, it's social, who do you spend time with, what do you do socially, it's intellect, do you read books, how do you continuously learn, it's physical, do you work out, are you eating the right things, are you getting enough sleep, and then it's career. So in your life, those are the seven pillars, and depending on what's going on in your life, you have to prioritize what's most important at that time. If you're married and your marriage is on the rocks, that might be the priority for you. If you don't have enough money in the bank or you just got fired, then career might be your number one priority. But it's balancing those things and keeping the three things that I talked about in balance, and just coming up with what's most important. What is the most important thing in your life today? And whatever that is, put some action plans to that, shore that up.
In your book, Sharp Leadership, Overcoming Adversity to Lead with Authenticity, you talk about how one might transform the trials and tribulations of life, both in leadership at home, in business, and their team. You know, what are some of the things you would give a leader, executive, advice on as they are establishing their priorities and looking at the priorities in life to basically equip them to go to the next level, Carl?
I would find out kind of what's going on, do an assessment of what's going on. And what I find a lot of times is it's not obvious. And you really have to develop a relationship to really get to the truth, because people are reluctant, especially leaders in organizations. I was coaching a guy, I was starting to coach a guy who was trying to get some business from this guy. And the person was very successful, retired military, running a big company, and da-da-da-da-da. So I'm talking to him, and he says, I don't mean to be spiteful or condescending, but how can you help me? I'm making this amount of money, right? I'm doing this, and how can you help me? So I flipped it and asked him a question. I said, well, let me ask you a question. What is it that a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, a CEO of a startup company, and a principal of a school, what do those three individuals have in common? He says, I don't know. I said, they don't have anybody they can talk to. Because when you get to that level, it's difficult to really be authentic and open with people that are working for you, you know, and then you throw in that ego piece. So one of the things I try to get across initially is being authentic, being real. And a lot of times there's things that need to be worked on that are kind of under the surface that you have to get through. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but a lot of times there's some trauma going on. And the other thing that I try to do is there's some things that I'm not equipped to do. So I might refer them to a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my pay grade only goes so high.
Well, we all try and stay in our lane, right?
Exactly.
So you speak nationally, Carl, and you talk about servant leadership, using adversity as a stepping stone, teamwork. Again, all of that, I'd say, grounded in a leadership innovation approach. And something you talk about in your book, I'd love to expound on, is how do you work with leaders to help them make every circumstance an opportunity?
Well, one of the things that I've learned, Tim, is that some of my biggest lessons have occurred in the darkest time. So I'll use the pandemic as an example. Okay, that's a great example. Crisis. People losing jobs, you know, family members coming home at each other's throat. It was a crisis, right? But there's a Chinese word. In China, the word crisis has two meanings. It's opportunity and it's peril. It's the same word, right? So if you think about learning and growing, in order to learn and grow, my experience has been, in order for me to really grow, I have to be uncomfortable. I have to be stretched. So when you have a crisis, you get stretched, which causes you to think totally different. And the thing that really boggles my mind, I'll use the restaurant industry as an example. Chick-fil-A's business went up 30% with the pandemic. The rest of the fast food restaurants are still status quo, and they haven't figured out what Chick-fil-A has done. You know, it's simple. Number one, they hire good people. They have a great culture, an open culture, where they do a good job of developing people, right? They treat their people with dignity. They tell the truth. They're closed on Sunday, which means there's at least one day that they're not working, right? And they're efficient and fast. But the other restaurants, for whatever reason, cannot duplicate that. So in order to grow, you have to be uncomfortable. So that's one of the things I tell people. So go do something that's different. I was talking to a young man who, he's at the Chamber of Commerce locally, and I was talking to him, and I saw where, I thought he was actually German. And I'm sitting down and talking to him, and he says, no, I grew up in Mississippi. And then in the 10th grade, I did a study abroad and it changed my life. And he said, then I went to Germany and did some semesters there. And anyway, he lived in Germany for 10 years. So when I run into somebody that has that type of international experience and things like that, I know that they've had to survive and thrive in an environment that was uncomfortable. And it gives them a whole different era about emotional intelligence, communication, listening, all those things like that. That's kind of what I would say on that.
Nah, that's fantastic, because I actually gave a talk back in May called Growth and Comfort Cannot Coexist. And the idea being that if you want to grow, you're going to have to be willing to get uncomfortable, in some cases very uncomfortable. And if you want to stay comfortable, which I think our society is somewhat lulling people into, then stay comfortable, but you most likely will not grow. In fact, you'll retrograde. I want to go back to the Chick-fil-A story, because I think it's a great story around innovation. I actually, my only fast food indulgence is Chick-fil-A, probably a little bit more than I should, but it's hard to resist a number one with a large unsweetened iced tea. And I was actually at a Chick-fil-A last Friday with my wife. We were running some errands, we're in the process of moving and had some stuff to do and needed a relatively quick meal. And she feels good with the salad there. That's a healthy option. I'm sticking with a number one combo. And I was shocked because we actually went in. I hadn't been in a Chick-fil-A in a while. You know, they changed their drive-thrus and all that. And we got tableside service by a young man. And it was fast and efficient, just as it would be always. But let's talk about innovation, because a lot of what you have spoken about in the past and what you really just spoke to about being uncomfortable is being willing to jump into a place of uncomfortability, which gives you a chance to innovate. And so much of what you said from a coaching perspective, Carl, of helping people that are completely out of balance in their professional and personal life requires them to innovate in the changing of their priorities. But what do you see as some of the important aspects of innovation in company and business cultures today?
I believe that people, as well as organizations, grow, shrink, and change all the time. So a good leader is always trying to get better. And to me, that's innovation. So that should be something that a leader should always be doing, as well as imparting upon the people that they work with and work and that they're over, to allow them to always be on the lookout for innovation and getting better. Now, in a lot of poorly run organizations, culture starts and falls with the leaders. So if the leader is a person that wants to grow the organization, wants to innovate in the organization, then that person will impart upon the people that they work around the same mindset. Okay. Now, the flip side of that is, let's say you have a leader who's insecure and is scared that somebody's going to take his or her place. Okay. Then that type of culture is embedded in the organization. So people are trying to determine what I can do to keep what I have and not let anybody know that I'm not really doing a whole lot. So innovation is continuously improving, and the culture is created by the leadership.
Yeah, I think that's a theme we cover in this podcast and have for the last 3 years. And you know, John Maxwell's got a great saying, you can't have a leader that's at a level 4 or 5 lead an organization that's at a level 7 or 9 or something will give there. And show me how a leader grows and I'll show you how the organization grows. That's, again, another maxim. You know, you touched on an unhealthy leadership culture, which I kind of refer to as the Hunger Games, where people are just trying to survive and the culture is one of more or less anything goes in order to survive. But, you know, in your coaching and speaking and consulting engagements, in addition to a leader that is committed to their own personal and professional growth and development, what are a couple of things you see consistently in healthy, innovative cultures?
One of the things that I see is that the leader sets the example and doesn't require anybody to do anything that they won't do. I believe that if you're equipping leaders to the next level and you want to have them do some things, I think that reading and continuously learning is something that's very, very important. And with technology today, you can basically learn anything you want without going to college, without getting a master's, without getting a PhD, any of that stuff, if you want to learn. And the thing about the learning piece, and I talked about being uncomfortable, is you got to read things that are going to stretch you. And you might want to read things about people that you don't know anything about. I did an assignment in New Jersey this last year, and I was like the chief culture officer. And 60% of the organization, their primary language was Spanish. 40% of the population was Hindi, and about 10% was French. So when you talk about how do you communicate, it's the first time I'd ever worked in an environment where I couldn't go on the line and talk to anybody in the organization and have them understand what I was saying. So I had to be real creative. What I found out was it's the same thing. I spent a lot of time talking to people, just being around, you know? And I use an example where I wanted to be like a fly on the wall. So I was around so much that they would behave however they normally behave. And I could see how they really behave and how things get done. If I'm in a meeting, I'm just in the meeting sitting and I'm taking notes and things like that. But being able to really understand the culture are some key things, doing a lot of listening. I was the interim director for a military veteran engagement at Clemson for about 6 months. And I came into an environment that was not very healthy. And it caused me to do a lot of listening because it was the first time in probably 20 years that I had been tethered to a desk from 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. I broke out in cold sweats for 2 weeks.
I bet you did. What am I doing?
And then my daughter, I was talking to my daughter, and she said, "Dad, if you were coaching somebody in your same situation, what would you tell them to do?" I said, "Well, I tell them to suck it up and figure it out." But that's what I did. I went in and put my head, I'm doing it. I did a lot of listening and, you know, learned and made a big change. So that's one of the things I tell people.
That's awesome.
Being present, listening is so critical.
Yeah. Well, people want to be heard. And there's a lot of communication outward, social media and otherwise, but not a lot of listening. Speaking of listening, you mentioned your daughter and your son. You have a new book. I'd love to talk a little bit about Sharp Leadership, Parenting Principles for Rearing Young People. And I know this is a passion of yours, in addition to all the work you've done as a coach and a speaker and a consultant, but I'd love to have you just talk about the book itself, what inspired you, prompted you to write it, and what you hope to accomplish by people reading it.
When I wrote my first book, people would ask me, "Do you have another book in you?" And I said 5 years ago when I authored it, I said, if I wrote another book, it would be about the rearing of my children. So August of last year, so last August, a year ago, I went in for a routine colonoscopy and they found a polyp. They took the polyp off, said probably no big deal. Doctor calls me Sunday morning. I'm thinking, oh, this can't be good news. He says that the polyp is cancerous. I need to do surgery, take 6 inches of your colon out, reattach it. But before that time, during the pandemic, I saw so many parents, in my opinion, struggling with the rearing of their children. 2 years old, 5 years old, 10 years old, 15 years old, 23 years old, and it's just eating in my heart, right? When I had the downtime to recover from the surgery, that's when I decided to put it to pen. And I started doing some research, and I didn't find any books on the market that had the same approach that I had. So I decided to do it. Because I had written a book before, the format is very similar, and I understood what the process was, and I had a lot of stories in my head. All the stories except for one are stories about my children and real life experiences. But the way I've raised my family, and I didn't know all this when I was going through it, but as I reflect back, some of it I did, most of it I did. So I tried to put in there things that I thought would be helpful in rearing children. One is, start with the end in mind. What's your vision of your child or your children? What do you want them to be ultimately? And then what skills do they need to have before they leave your house at the age of 18? And you're assuming that at 18, they're going to go to the military, they're going to go to college, they're going to go work, they're going to be out the house. But if that's the goal, then what kind of things do you need to do between 0 and 18 to make sure that they're equipped to be successful on their own? They need to know how to manage their money. They need to know how to work. They need to know how to develop healthy relationships. They need to know how to do their laundry. They need to know how to get around in the city or wherever they're living, right? All those skills they need to have by the time they leave the nest at the age of 18. And it can be done, but you have to strategically, you know, be willing to do that. And even if your son or daughter plans to go to a quote unquote Christian college, there's still wolves in sheep's clothing. And that communication piece and being able to develop healthy relationships is something that you have to nurture. And I believe that one of the things that we had our kids do was we'd have them in extracurricular activities. And during the summers and other places, we would have them go someplace, which would force them to make relationships with different people. So that the first time they have to develop new relationships isn't when they're 18 and going to college. That's not a good look, right? So starting with the end in mind. The other one is making everything a teachable moment. Every opportunity is an opportunity to teach and having conversation. You did that? Okay, so why did you do that? What are you going to get out of that? And there's a lot of examples that they're going to run into with teammates, classmates, teachers, and all that stuff. So every time there's an opportunity to make it a teaching moment, I think it's critical. Another key thing in the book talks about being consistent. I was the owner of a German Shepherd dog named Sheik. Bought him when he was 6 weeks old. I was in the neighborhood one day, and I ran into a guy that had a Doberman. This Doberman was trained on lead, off lead, sit, stay. I was impressed. So I asked the owner, I said, man, I'd like to have my dog do that. He says, well, you know, I can help you and your dog do that. If you give me the dog for about 6 weeks, I'll train the dog, and then I'll train you. And I said, do you really think she can do this and catch on? He says, I'm not worried about Sheik. I'm worried about you. And it's the same thing in parenting. It's not the parents. It's the children. You know, the dog will get it. You know?
Man.
So what I learned with training a dog was you got to be consistent. You got to be consistent. And when the dog does something that's not good, you make a quick correction and you forget about it. And you try to find the dog doing something positive and you praise them up. It's the same thing with people. Try to find them doing something good. When they do something that you don't like, quick correction, don't keep harping on it. And the other thing it talks about is it's all about relationships. Teaching your young people that building relationships is so very important. Submitting to authority is so important. You know, doing a good job, do what you say you're going to do. Be a person of your word. And then the last pillar I would consider to be faith. Faith, family, and friends. And I believe that if you believe that you are the smartest in the world and you are the ultimate power, then that's a problem. So I give examples of how do you strengthen yourself with your faith and walk that out.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's obviously a very timely topic. And I think one of the key things you mentioned there, Carl, is the intentionality and the consistency of that intentionality and that whole idea of beginning with the end in mind. I think when it comes to innovation as well, we talked about that. I'm sure Chick-fil-A, when they said, how are we going to navigate this pandemic? They said, you know, what do the stores need to look like? How do we need to adapt if people aren't coming into the stores, which for a while was the case, but really love the consistency of your message and your teaching across so many disciplines in life, whether it's business, entrepreneurship, being a father, and sharing your wisdom through your book. So really appreciate, Carl, just taking the time to be with us today. Is there anything when you think about either innovation or leadership or parenting, you know, the audience for our podcast or entrepreneurs and business owners that are trying to create winning cultures in their business, in their life, is there any parting thoughts you'd like to share?
Yeah, there's several points that I'll mention. As I think about what kind of things do leaders need in order to motivate others, and I thought I did a quick list of about 10 things. One is love and listen. Number two is speak the truth. The third one is do what you say you're going to do. Only 20%, I use the Pareto principle a lot, only 20% of the people do what they say they're going to do. If you can be a leader where people can bank on what you say, that just elevates you to the stratosphere. Number four, build relationships. It's all about relationships. Nobody gets to where they are without relationships. Know what your goals are. Know what the goals of your people are. And help them reach those goals that they're looking for. One of the things that I do is when I join up with an organization, I sit down with them and I say, tell you a little bit about myself. You tell me a little bit about yourself. I'm going to tell you what my expectations are of you. You tell me what your expectations are of me. And I want to know how I can help you. And all I have to do is identify one of those things, right? And I do that with the quote unquote troublemakers in an organization. Every organization has them. Somebody that talks all the time, you know, doesn't do anything. What I found is those troublemakers a lot of times are the smartest people in the organization and nobody listens to them. So if I go into an organization, I go to the troublemaker, listen to them, help them fix one thing that they're working on. It could be work or family. I have someone lead interference for me in that entire organization. And I'll pick them all one at a time. Give people the tools to solve problems. And always give accurate, timely, and specific feedback. Catch people doing well. Catch them doing good. Number 9, lead by example. People would rather see a sermon than hear a sermon. And then make everything a teachable moment.
Yes, I hear what you say, but I watch what you do. Yeah, very true. Well, that's a great top 10. Carl, I really appreciate your time with us today and the work you're doing. And just appreciate our listeners joining us today for another episode of Winning Through Culture with Carl Sharperson. We'll have his contact information in our show notes and a link to his books. And until we're together again, be impactful and relevant. Thank you.
Thank you.